You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of November, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, ahead of the Kuwaiti elections this weekend, we ask, will they be free and fair, and how will the region react should the Islamist party win again?
Kuwait Emir recently made a unilateral change to the electoral law, which is expected to disfavour the opposition. You've now got quite a significant movement of people calling to boycott the election.
Also on the show, the Dutch parliament throws out blasphemy laws and Jim Beam whiskey takes Russia by storm. And... well, just guess who's coming to town. With the Monocle Christmas Market on this weekend right here at Midori House, we say hello to one very special guest, Santa Claus. Christmas on the radio then, and lots more coming up over the next hour, right here on Midori House. But first, let us catch up on the headlines with our newsman, Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Israel has authorized the construction of 3,000 more houses in the occupied Palestinian territories. It's thought they'll be built in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority says it will not return to peace talks without a freeze in settlement building. The reports come a day after a vote at the UN General Assembly upgraded the Palestinian status at the UN to that of non-member observer. Protesters opposed to Egypt's president and the wide-ranging new powers he gave himself last week have gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square hours after a new constitution was hastily approved. The Islamist-dominated assembly finished voting on the draft in the early hours of Friday. Mr. Morsi is now expected to call a referendum. The Supreme Constitutional Court is due to rule on Sunday on whether the assembly should be dissolved. The number of jobless people in the Eurozone has reached a new high, and the poor state of the economy is reducing inflation to almost its lowest level for 2 years. The new figures from the EU's statistics office, Eurostat, raise the prospect of more interest rate cuts by the European Central Bank as the Eurozone sinks into its second recession since 2009. Jonathan Todd, spokesman for the EU's Commissioner for Employment, says the figures are worrying.
The unemployment rate has crept up to 10.6, from 10.6 to 10.7% in the 27 member states and from 11.6 to 11.7% in the euro area, which are historically very high levels. And we now have almost 26 million people unemployed in Europe.
Victims of press intrusion are urging the British government to fully implement the recommendations of an inquiry on newspaper regulation. Following his inquiry lasting just over a year, Lord Justice Leveson has called for a new independent watchdog, which he says should be underpinned by legislation. Leveson inquiry witnesses Jerry McCann, whose little girl Madeline went missing 5 years ago, and Christopher Jeffries, wrongly arrested for a murder in Bristol after a newspaper identified him, launched the online petition run by the campaign group Hacked Off. Ministers say a draft bill on the report will be ready in a fortnight. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations are criticising China's plan to board and search ships that illegally enter what it considers its territory in the disputed South China Sea. Southeast Asia's top diplomat is warning a code of conduct needs to be urgently discussed to prevent increasing tension in the region. ASEAN Secretary General Surin Pitsuwan in Bangkok says he's very worried at China's plan.
We have to be extremely careful not to let the issue be a cause of so much concern, so much worries, so much anxieties. I know that all parties are trying to work out some measure that would reduce a chance of misunderstanding, a chance of miscalculation, but I think a lot of people are concerned.
Former IMF chief Dominic Strauss-Kahn is reported to have reached a preliminary agreement with a hotel maid, Nafissatou Diallo, who accused him of sexual assault last year. The French daily newspaper Le Monde claims the parties had agreed on a payment of $6 million to settle the civil lawsuit she brought against him. That claim is being dismissed by Strauss-Kahn's lawyers as fanciful. The affair ended the Frenchman's International Monetary Fund career and wrecked his presidential ambitions. A desk which once belonged to a French royal mistress is going under the hammer next week at Christie's Auction House in London. It's expected to fetch £20 million, that's around $32 million. The 18th century secretaire is the centrepiece of a sale of a private art collection, and Madame de Pompadour, who owned it, was the mistress of Louis XV. The ormolu-mounted Japanese lacquer piece was carved by Bernard II van Rissenberg, otherwise known as BVRB, and is thought to be where love letters to the French king were written. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill, and it's 6 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljati, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24. Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
First up on Midori House, what do you do when you, the people, democratically elect an assembly, yet the winning Islamist party is not favoured by the government and the courts? Simple. If you follow Kuwait's example, the emir will dissolve the parliament and reinstate the previous assembly allied to the ruling family as per earlier this year. This weekend sees Kuwait's second parliamentary election of the year, and tensions between the parliament and the government are spilling out onto the streets. Jane Kinnamount, senior research fellow at the Chatham House Middle East and North Africa program, talked with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield from Kuwait. In the wake of a dissolved parliament, Steve asked what the chances are for a free and fair election.
Well, the elections themselves are going to have some international monitoring, at least, but the real controversy has been around the electoral law. Kuwait Emir recently made a unilateral change to the electoral law, which is expected to disfavour the opposition. And there's been a big outcry here because many people felt that it should not have been done in such a top-down way. You've now got quite a significant movement of people calling to boycott the election.
Now, Kuwait is, obviously, it's run by a royal family. There is an element of democracy. I mean, the very fact that we are having elections suggests that. What sort of democracy is Kuwait, and how much has that democracy developed over the last 10, 20 years?
Kuwait is the closest thing that the Gulf has to a constitutional monarchy. I mean, there are elections to parliaments in several other Gulf countries, but the parliaments tend to be toothless. In Kuwait, the parliament does actually have some powers to block things that the emir and the government would like to do. Unfortunately, the situation with the parliament has become very dysfunctional in recent years, and the parliament has actually been dissolved 5 times in 5 years. The problem is really that the parliament is very powerful up to a point, but once it clashes with the government, the emir does have the right to dissolve it and call new elections. And what's been happening repeatedly is, instead of being able to find a way to resolve disputes with the parliament, they have just been increasingly resorting to dissolving it. That means every time you get a new parliament, people expect it to last only a few months, and MPs have no incentive to actually develop long-term policies. The last election here was only in February.
When we look ahead to what comes next, I mean, all the Arab monarchies have survived to a certain extent. Many have had to change their governments, but the monarchies themselves have stayed in place. Do you think, looking more generally through the region, that all those Arab monarchies will be able to survive the next few years as well?
No, I don't think that's at all guaranteed. I think people look at the last couple of years and think, well, republics have seen changes of leader and monarchs haven't. But if you look back over the longer sweep of history, you know, over the past sort of 7 decades, most of the republics were monarchies before. There's nothing particularly unique about monarchies that mean that they have to last, and much really depends how they meet these challenges. You've seen a lot of diversity among the monarchies. I mean, at one end of the spectrum, you have Morocco, which has embarked on some quite serious constitutional reforms. At the other end of the spectrum, you have places like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which have had no real political reforms, and if anything, have become somewhat more repressive. Or you have Bahrain, which has seen the most pronounced protests of any of the monarchies and has become increasingly reliant on external support from Saudi Arabia in order to ensure its security and its economic well-being. So, yeah, I think their survival isn't guaranteed, and really it depends how able they are to adapt to the changing expectations of a growing youthful population, many of whom have higher aspirations than their parents' generation did in terms of political participation and also in terms of living standards.
Now, the US is a key ally of Kuwait. The US also relies to a certain extent on Kuwait's oil. Throughout the Arab uprisings, the US has been playing a slightly careful game, working out who to back and which old allies it's going to, it might then dump. Do you get any sense that the US is willing to reappraise their relationship with the Kuwaiti royal family?
I don't see any indications of that. I think the relations between Kuwait and the West are very good, and indeed the Emir of Kuwait was just on a state visit to the UK earlier this week and signed various cooperation agreements, I believe including a security cooperation agreement with the UK. But I don't think the US has so much to worry about when it comes to Kuwait as compared to some of its other allies in the region. I mean, there is a quite serious dispute in Kuwait about the new electoral law, and there's a longer-term issue about the extent to which the royal family will be willing to share power. At the same time, this is a country that has brought a parliament and it has relative freedom of speech, and most people are not calling for the overthrow of the monarchy. I've just been at a large opposition rally in the centre of Kuwait City, and the main slogan that they're chanting, the people want the downfall of the decree, meaning the electoral law, whereas in other countries people were shouting people want the downfall of the regime. I think the US has more serious worries when it looks at some of the other Gulf monarchies, notably Bahrain, where the repression has been getting a lot worse in recent weeks.
And that was Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House talking a little earlier with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. We'll be back in a moment to hear how you can finally, legally blaspheme in the Netherlands.
On assignment around the world, Monocle editors take notes on exceptional finds, from hotels to airports, luggage brands to snacks. And in our travel top 50, we share them with you.
No long-distance train ride would be complete without the perfect meal. A Japanese bento box stuffed with a sampling of the season's best is our favourite lunch on the go. And possibly just our favourite lunch. Tokyo Station's Ebinya Matsuri sells more than 150 types of bento box meals that are shipped in daily from all over the Japanese archipelago.
Discover the best in service, smiles and seamless connections by watching our Travel Top 50 slideshow on monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House. It is no longer a crime in the Netherlands to insult God. The country's political leaders decided Dutch laws on blasphemy were no longer relevant, so this week they were repealed. Mind you can still go to jail for insulting the police or Queen Beatrix. However, in repealing the blasphemy laws, Holland is now more in step with most of Europe, although there are exceptions. Paul Marshall is Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom and the author and editor of more than 20 books on religion and politics. Hello, Paul Marshall.
Hello, Nancy.
Is this a good move?
I think it's a good move, but it's essentially symbolic. It makes no substantial difference. The Netherlands and many other countries still have a religious insult law, which in practical terms strongly restricts what you can say about religion. The focus is now blasphemy laws were sort of, you can't insult God directly. That's now allowed in the Netherlands. But if you insult another person on thought to be on grounds of their religion, then you can still be prosecuted.
Yeah, so like no difference at all then?
It's not no difference. The blasphemy law has gone, but it hasn't been used for 50 years. Whereas religious insult laws, and which are present in most of the major countries of Europe, and Britain has a similar type of law, they are the most dangerous ones, and those are the ones which are getting used. In the Netherlands, for example, last year before, the politician Geert Wilders was charged with religious insult. In the end, he was acquitted, but the process took, I think, over 12 months to get through.
So that was not connected with the blasphemy law. It was something separate.
Correct. It was not a blasphemy law per se. It was whether or not his criticisms of Islam as a religion, as you know, he made very critical remarks about Islam, about the nature of the Quran, and insulted those. His defense was, which the court upheld, was he never insulted Muslims. Muslims themselves may be very nice. It's the beliefs and teaching of Islam which he was attacking. So in the case of the Netherlands, he got an acquittal of that. But in other cases with Finnish politicians and people in Austria and elsewhere, they have been convicted of religious insult. These are the laws which are having most of the effect right now in Europe.
Okay, well, before we follow on with those for a bit, the blasphemy laws in Europe, they still exist in some places. And, for instance, didn't Ireland tighten up its law very recently?
Yes, Ireland's extremely unusual. The pattern for most of Europe, at least Western Europe, has been to drop these laws, or simply, if they're still on the books, which they are in half a dozen countries, not to use them. But Ireland was a funny case in that its constitution requires a blasphemy law, and the government didn't, in fact, want one. I think the majority of people in Ireland were against it, but was, in fact, a constitutional requirement that they have one, so they've instituted one. I doubt that it will be used. It's a sort of quirk of the law rather than anything else.
Special case. I guess last question, if I could, do you think that the lifting of these laws, the repealing of the laws, will lead to some amount outpouring of blasphemy in the Netherlands?
No, I think that's unlikely. Blasphemy, at least in the traditional sense, is extremely widespread in the Netherlands and in most of Europe. And many of our TV programs, a lot of the BBC could be prosecuted under that. Britain doesn't have many more, but under the old blasphemy laws, they could. But nobody was doing it. The focus now is on hurting other people's feelings or insulting them. So I don't think there'll be more blasphemy.
Okay, we tread on eggshells here. Anyway, thank you very much for this. Paul Marshall, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom. Thanks very much. You're listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham. Well, Jim Beam may just be a middle-of-the-road liquor to whiskey connoisseurs, but the producers of the American drink are introducing it to Russia as a luxury brand, and Russia's vodka-soaked market is buying it. Despite Vladimir Putin's muscular new laws cracking down on alcohol consumption, Jim Beam is defying the state and taking the fight to its main competitor, Jack Daniel's. Well, to help us find out more about how Russia is responding to the expansion of such a premium liquor, we're joined now by Duane Stanford of Bloomberg Business Week. Hello there.
Hello.
This is an interesting thing. I mean, Jim Beam, I sort of remember that as a teenager in Canada being something people had that wasn't really very special.
Yeah, you're right. As happens often in this kind of trade around the world, brands that are rather pedestrian at times in one country turn out to be a premium offering in another country where, you know, people are interested in, especially in Russia, in sort of the Western cachet and interested in what Americans are drinking and in some ways trying to push away from their past.
Has Jim Beam repackaged it itself any differently, done anything to kind of rebrand itself, or is it that same sort of clunky, slightly bumpy bottle as I remember?
Yeah, no, it's the same bottle, and in fact, it's imported from the United States, so it's not even produced there. So really, what they're selling is sort of this American idea. There's this really interesting bar in the heart of Moscow that actually trades on the whole notion of prohibition in the 20s and even some of the Western American culture. And the whole idea there is a whiskey bar, you know, where you go and have an American good time. So those are the kinds of places that they're really trying to cultivate this brand and really trying to introduce it to Russians who typically, you know, as you know, drink a lot of vodka.
Well, exactly. And is this going to dent the vodka market?
Yeah, it's I tell you, vodka, which is about 80% of the sales there, and Russia drinks about 45% of the vodka distributed around the world. Those sales are down. They're down about 4.9%, while whiskey is up 48%. Now, that's a really small base. It's a lot less being sold there, but it's the thing that's actually growing. So they are drinking it up.
And is there a heavy-duty promotional campaign going on?
Yeah, I tell you, a lot of what they have to do, because there are a lot of new restrictions coming into the market there, Putin's really cracking down on alcoholism. They're trying to help Russians live longer. And one of the things they've done is impose new taxes. They've imposed restrictions over the years on advertising. So really what a brand like Jim Beam and Jack Daniels have to do there is market the actual brand identity and hit the bars. One of the programs that Beam has, in fact, is to send lovely ladies into bars to give blind taste tests to patrons who are drinking one of the competitors' brands. So that's a lot of the kind of activity you see there.
I can just picture it. Well, one could say it's rather cynical of Jim Beam to be pushing its booze out like this in a country that really does have serious alcohol problems.
Yeah, a lot of the problem there, according to the experts, has to do with this very low-end, especially low-end vodka, where you can buy it for $6 a bottle. That's the kind of alcohol that's being purchased very readily, consumed very heavily, and is the predominant drink of folks that have these sorts of problems. So at least the way they see it, they see that they're offering a premium offering to the higher-end set, the growing middle class. So they don't believe they're contributing to that. But again, you know, alcohol is alcohol, so it's absolutely something that waters that they're going to have to navigate as they move forward.
Okay, thank you, Duane Stanford of Bloomberg Business Week. Well, listening in on that is our very own correspondent in Moscow, Peter Van Dyke. Hello.
Hello there.
Have you been running into and tripping over bottles of Jim Beam everywhere you turn?
I can't say I have, and as Duane said, the market for whiskey here is very, very small compared with vodka. I think, as he said, vodka 80% and whiskey probably around about 1%, maybe creeping up towards 2% of the liquor market. So I haven't bumped into any myself. But then, you know, I'm not hitting the bars and likely to bump into any of the scantily clad young women who are peddling it either, unfortunately.
You're working too hard. We'll have to send you out on a special assignment, I think.
Oh, yeah, well, I'll talk to the editors to commission that one.
Okay, but look, tell me something about how you think this might appeal to the Russian drinker, this Jim Beam, the slightly macho, I think, and in southern United States image of a good time, small town in a saloon. Can you see that playing out there?
I definitely can. As you said, slightly macho. This is quite a macho society, and you know, where men are men, and this sort of drinking culture and image, when you can combine that with also a certain upmarket cachet, which Western brands do have, and particularly alcohol brands, then yes, it's something that could well appeal. And as we've seen, the growth in Beam sales over the past year has been considerable from a very low base, and whiskey in general. So it is something that is going to maybe catch on and do good things in a market where these sorts of drinks are expanding their market share quite dramatically. And obviously, all companies look for growth. In fact, in a similar vein, Budweiser just launched over here in the past. I think it was the middle of last year or late last year. Even we hadn't had Budweiser in the country, so they did a big launch over here. And again, something that perhaps in the US is not considered to be a top brand, something that does market itself a little bit higher in the UK, and again markets itself a little bit higher here as well. So it is a trend that the Western alcohol companies are looking to tap into.
Okay, and Peter, just a quickie as we wrap up, how does this sit with the Russian government's attempts to get people to curtail their drinking?
Well, as Dwayne said, the minimum price of vodka is actually set half a litre. It's around about $3 or $4. They're going to increase it probably to $6 or so next year, similar to what the Conservative government in Britain is talking about doing. So they're aiming at a very, very different market. But the wholesale ban on lots of different kinds of alcohol advertising does make it hard for a brand to get that sort of recognition. And that is something that any brand here, especially one who's quite new to the market, does have to work on. So that is the area in which they're particularly challenged.
Very good. Thank you so much. Peter van Dijk, Monocle's correspondent in Moscow.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Now we're just going to slow the pace down a little bit, play you a song by Maya Hawthorne, and it's called Just Ain't Gonna Work Out.
But I'm sorry, 'cause it just ain't working.
Maya Hawthorne, lovely song there, Just Ain't Gonna Work Out.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The Propa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Este é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
This is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we're going to hear from Brazilian author Bruna Fonte about her new book on bossa nova. We'll meet our cinematic neighbors in the heart of London, and we'll also welcome a very special Yuletide guest to the show. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Israel has authorized the construction of 3,000 more houses in the occupied Palestinian territories. It's thought they'll be built in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority says it will not return to peace talks without a freeze in settlement building. Protesters opposed to Egypt's president and the wide-ranging new powers he gave himself last week have gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square, hours after a new constitution was hastily approved. The Islamist-dominated assembly finished voting on the draft in the early hours of Friday. Mr. Morsi is now expected to call a referendum. The number of jobless people in the Eurozone has reached a new high, and the poor state of the economy is reducing inflation to almost its lowest level for 2 years. The new figures from the EU Statistics Office, Eurostat, raise the prospect of more interest rate cuts by the European Central Bank as the Eurozone sinks into its second recession since 2009. 26 million people are thought to be without work. Victims of press intrusion are urging the British government to fully implement the recommendations of an inquiry on newspaper regulation. Following his inquiry lasting just over a year, Lord Justice Leveson has called for a new independent watchdog, which he says should be underpinned by legislation. Former IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn is reported to have reached a preliminary agreement with the hotel maid Nafissatou Diallo, who accused him of sexual assault last year. The French daily newspaper Le Monde claims the parties had agreed on a payment of $6 million to settle the civil lawsuit she brought against him. That claim is being dismissed by Strauss-Kahn's lawyers as fanciful. And a desk once belonging to a French royal mistress is going under the hammer next week at Christie's Auction House in London. It's expected to fetch £20 million. That's around $32 million. The 18th century secretaire is the centrepiece of a sale of a private art collection. The desk once belonged to Madame de Pompadour, who was the mistress of Louis XV. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham, and we're coming to you live from London. Yesterday saw the publication of a hugely significant report here in London as Lord Justice Leveson released the first stages of his findings about the practices and ethics of the press. To gain insight into the key findings of the report and its implications for journalism in the UK, Monocle's Tom Edwards and Marcus Hippie talked with Gavin McFadyen, director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism, and they asked him first if there were any surprises.
Yes, there were some. I was quite surprised by its lack of teeth in two ways. The first was the controversy about controlling the press, which he kind of avoids by not making very specific suggestions about what could be done. And second, and probably by far I think the most important, is his failure to confront the police. The police omission is, I think, the most serious and most interesting aspect of the report. The fact that the police didn't follow through after actually years of serious complaints, and they had the sufficient power to do it, raises enormous questions about the law and how it's actually executed in the country. Because this report said that the police, in fact, performed admirably.
I meant to some concern about that myself, but I wonder, do you think that because of these pending criminal cases that are ongoing, to a certain extent, the worst excess is some of these issues of corrupt payments, that kind of thing. And there's already legislation in place that deals with that. If there's criminal behaviour, for example, corruption, that can be dealt with by existing criminal statutes. So is that a reason why maybe he's sidestepping it slightly?
I could see that, except that the police themselves are not charged. In other words, all the police who are guilty of accepting money from Rebecca Wade and others are not charged. There's no perjury being suggested against their testimony, even though they admit to having ignored hundreds of cases of genuine abuse that had been done. I think he says, Leveson, in the report, that the failure to act by the police was only a theoretical question. It's an odd construction to say. He says that it was a theoretical question. He thought they were probably too close, some of them, to the News International and its staff, and that had led, perhaps intuitively, he says, to a rather greater reluctance fully to investigate what had happened at the News of the World. But he then goes on to say that the police actually were fine, that there was nothing really wrong. He says, because of its importance to the reputation of the Metropolitan Police, each step of the way in which this operation was executed and later reviewed has been analyzed, he says, in great detail. And he then says, I am satisfied that I have seen no basis for challenging the integrity of the police or that of the senior police officers concerned.
Well, one suggestion to come out of this report is a suggestion for an independent body that would basically follow media's behavior. How do you understand this? What would this kind of institution look like?
Well, it would probably look like all the others that they've established in this way, which would be the grand and the good, largely people who probably don't know a lot about how the media works, passing judgment on the media after the fact, after huge damage has probably already been done. The commercial incentive has to be attacked for sensationalism. Otherwise, sensationalism will continue. And the real problem here is the ghastly abuse that pure sensationalist behavior by the press actually endorses. So you've got to attack it, I think, at its source, which this report sadly doesn't do. It reminds me of sort of Hutton Part 2, I mean, where everybody walks and nobody's blamed for anything. And it is quite astonishing, because the police do have powers to intervene in the Privacy Act, wiretapping legislation, all of the rest of it, nothing's done. And all the people who then lied to the press and to the public are excused. And he actually says some extraordinary things here. I copied some of them out this morning. It really quite surprising. He says, the approach of the police, though, was insufficiently thought through and unduly defensive. But he then says, he compliments the police with words like thoroughness, good sense, appropriate, judicious, and a positive response. The only people who don't figure in this are the victims.
Mm. Gavin McFadden, you are incredibly critical about all this. Is there anything in the report that you are delighted by?
I think drawing attention to the commercial necessity of sensationalism is a very good thing. And I think that the report addresses what genuinely disturbs a lot of people. But on the other hand, I think we try to look at these things critically rather than we're not stenographers. I think we have to say that when things are wrong, they're wrong and they should be said to. I mean, Hutton, nobody now in their right mind would suggest that the Hutton report of some years back was a good report. They would say, in fact, it was a whitewash. And I suspect they will be saying that about this too once the hubbub dies.
Just on another one of these interesting kind of, I guess it's almost a commercial imperative. We've talked about the relationship between the police and the press. What about the relationship between political parties and the press? Too cozy, I guess most observers of the media here or anywhere for that matter would find it unsurprising. Do you think it's realistic to try and tackle that? Because the same kind of imperatives, they may not be explicitly commercial, but they're about, you know, the realities of getting into office, maintaining some kind of coherent grip on power. Do you feel the report delves into that at all in any adequate
way? I don't think it does, sadly. I think the problem is that we don't have an opposition in Britain. Both parties operate on the same basic premise, which is to get elected, and the program is much secondary to that primary imperative. So you've got a problem where they both, political parties, were very close to News International, very close to socially, both the Conservatives and the Labour Party. We forget that Tony Blair was very close to the same people and endorsed the same things and prepared to do a great deal to mollify Murdoch and his friends. And I think that's part of the problem. Because if we had a genuine opposition in that sense, like we see on the continent or even sometimes in America, this would have been exposed, I think, long before. It would have been in somebody's political interest to say, hold on a minute, this is far too close, far too dangerous, actually, to the democratic process.
Do you think something will change in this country after this report, or even abroad? Obviously, when we've been looking at the front pages internationally, this report has been getting incredible amount of attention there as well.
It has, because it's had a lot of attention here. I mean, the media here is very, like we all are, very self-referential. We tend to be concerned in great detail with anybody talking about us. I think the truth is that very little will probably come from this. There'll be a very grand board probably appointed, which will make pronouncements. Then probably very little will happen. I mean, it's the idea that would Murdoch, who had determined all the policies of News International in all of its complexity and all of its purpose, would he ever be charged? The answer is no.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, Desde Londres,
Holanda,
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, if you weren't already aware, we here at Midori House are going to be indulging in some Yuletide festivities this coming weekend. And please come and see us at the Monocle Christmas Market if you are nearby. One very special guest is on his way to us tonight. And with clear skies, you might even glimpse him as he flies from the north with his reindeer and sleigh. Well, we chatted just before he took off from Finland, where he'd stopped after visiting Japan. Good evening, Santa Claus.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm fine. Yourself?
I'm very well, too, thank you. We're all excited about meeting you tomorrow. You're on your way here. Where are you now?
I am now at the Helsinki area.
Are your reindeer all ready for the journey overnight?
Oh, yes. Rudolph starts getting ready. When the first snow hit the ground, I can see how he's getting anxious and he's, you know, and then he starts, doing things with the other reindeers, sort of, you know, like bossing them around with an exercise, this and that and everything. You know.
Can you see them? Are they next to you right now?
Not at the moment, no. I just came in, you know, having a chat with them.
And you've been flying around the world with them to visit people?
Yes, a little bit. But of course, Christmas Eve is the big night.
But you've already been making some appearances, and I wanted to ask you what children are asking for this year. What are you hearing?
Oh, all sorts of things. We were just the other night speaking about this with the elves, and of course, the modern days have brought all technical stuff into this, you know, wishing lists. And we realized that still the very, very old, the very, very traditional thing is still there, and that is that the boys, they want engines and machines and tractors and lorries and cars and things like that. Girls want, you know, books and clothes and puppets and things like that. But like I said, modern technology is there, of course.
What about the grown-ups? What do you hear from them this year? Are there any trends?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are people who have sort of, how would I say it, settled down from the really trendy and this rush, rush, hush, hush, you know, there. But, yeah, sometimes I must say, to be quite honest with you, I must say that sometimes the adults maybe go too much with the trend.
May I ask how old you are?
What about if I return the question, eh?
I'm asking the questions here.
You know what happened to me? I was one evening sitting in my big, big rocking chair in the front of my big, big fireplace. And I started thinking, you know, this, how many Christmas do I remember? And I started counting them. And you know what happened to me? I got to about 364 and I fell asleep. Must be somewhere around 400 then, wasn't it?
I guess so. How many elves have you got working for you?
I'd say there are at least as many of the elves as there are stars in the sky, I would say. It comes pretty close. If it's a cloudy night, then we have more.
No wonder they get the job done then. Hey, you're going to be flying through the clear skies, as far as I can tell, here in the UK anyway tonight, and we'll be seeing you tomorrow and Sunday at the Monocle Christmas Market. Are you looking forward to it?
Very much so, you know, it's really a nice privilege to have a couple of days. And, of course, the Monocle Christmas Market does have a good reputation, so always nice to be part of these things.
Some elves here on the scene have been doing some very good advanced work for you, making your grotto ready. And what? How does it work for you? Will you be sitting in there and having people sit on your knees?
Yeah, well, there's so many things to do, you know. I mean, I have the post office here, so we get about... varies a little bit, but you know, between 500,000 and 700,000 letters from around or over 130-140 countries. Then we have lots of visitors. I mean, just the summer gone by, during one day we counted 47 different nationalities. That's a lot of cultures, I tell you.
Well, that's great. And tomorrow and Sunday, the children will have a chance to line up and tell you their wishes.
That'll be nice. I look so much forward to, because I know I'm going to see a lot of sparkling faces.
He sure will. And bring your sparkling faces to us, the Monocle Christmas Market, tomorrow and Sunday, 11 to 5 in London. It's going to be a really great time. Thank you very much, Santa Claus, for chatting with us before you took off on your flight to London.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
When you think about Brazil, bossa nova might well be one of the first things that comes to mind. The breezy rhythm, the girl from Ipanema, the wonderful landscape of Rio de Janeiro. Bossa nova is a genre of music that has taken on global popularity. The Brazilian journalist Bruna Fonte is co-author of a book just out in Brazil. It's called Acetal de Bossa Nova, which means lovely bossa nova. And our resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke with her and began by asking where she got the idea for the book.
So I started working with Roberto Menescal in 2008. And we met, and he's one of the most important musicians in Brazil. And I had the idea to talk about his life and bossa nova. And we started working in 2008. In 2010, we released a book called O Baquinho Vai, Roberto Menescal e Suas Histórias, which is his biography. And now we are releasing Essa Tal de Bossa Nova, our new book with stories about bossa nova and Brazilian music.
Can you, first of all, I think there is an event, this Carnegie Hall show, that actually presented bossa nova to the world. It's been 50 years. Can you tell us about this special show?
Yes. 50 years ago, the whole people from bossa nova, Antônio Carlos Jobim, João Gilberto, Roberto Menescal, Carlos Lira, they had this concert at Carnegie Hall, the first bossa nova concert right in Brazil. And it was the most important concert because they were not professional musicians, but they started with this concert at Carnegie Hall when the people from around the world met their music, and that's why this concert is so important for our music.
And bossa nova as well is the kind of one of the first genuinely made in Brazil movements, correct?
I guess it's correct. Yes, because bossa nova is the first movement made from young people. They used it to live in the beach, Rio de Janeiro, and they made songs about their lives.
Here at Monaco, we love to listen to bossa nova. And, for example, how important for Brazil's image abroad was bossa nova?
Well, bossa nova translates Brazilian soul. That's why people like so much and always makes an association between Brazil and bossa nova. Bossa nova always speaks about the beautiful landscapes in Brazil, our kind of life, beautiful places we have. That's why bossa nova is so popular around the world.
Name like a classic bossa nova song for you.
Well, I think it's O Barquinho, you know, the little boat.
I know.
Very beautiful song written by Menescal and Boscoli, but they're also Out of Key and Chega de Saudade, Waves, and some other beautiful songs.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bruna. And actually, we're going to play a little bit of Roberto Menescal with O Barquinho.
Mas só você,
tristeza que eu criei,
sonhei
você pra mim.
Mas pra mim, você, você, você.
And that was O Barquinho by Roberto Menescal. Well, every Friday we like to step out and meet our neighbors around Midori House. This time we go to the Everyman Baker Street Cinema. It's a very cozy cinema indeed, located in the heart of busy Baker Street and run by manager Tumi Itolang.
The cinema's been around for a lot longer than Everyman. Everyman only took over the site in the last 4 years, and yeah, essentially it's a cinema. I mean, it does what every other cinema does. It, you know, we exhibit films, mainstream, independent cinema, everything, a mix of everything really. But Everyman has taken the approach of being all about the service side of it. So you come in and you have an experience from the moment you walk in. It's more about you're going to come in, relax in the lounge, have a coffee, have a martini, relax with friends, and then you might decide to watch a film afterwards. That is the whole ethos behind Everyman. You know, it's about the experience more than the actual film. You can watch a great film, but you can come out and have a shot of tequila afterwards. and relax with your friends. From today, we're showing Great Expectations, small film, probably never heard of it, and Skyfall. Bond, 007.
We're blind here. What's going on?
I'm still with them.
Give me CCTV, satellite, anything.
Sofas, good-looking staff, sexy bar. Hopefully that's the impression that we give. That's what we aim for. In total, we have 9 cinemas. In London, we have 6. They're in Hampstead, Belsize Park, Maidenvale, and it's all about, you know, every site is individual. They're all in cinemas that were there before, except we've adapted them to become Everyman. So the lounges have gone from being just an average cinema lounge to having sofas like where we're sat right now, and carpeted floors. That's what it's about. The staff, I think, make Baker Street, Baker Street. Other than that, we are the only site in the company that is underground, a basement venue. And I think that lends to the idea that people find this a cozy place to relax. You know, you come in here and you walk down, there's framed posters of, you know, comic book films or comic books or Lord of the Rings, whatever it may be. You get downstairs and it's nothing like you'd expect from outside. There's a big box office, a canopy like any other cinema, but you get downstairs and suddenly you're in a different world. You have the whole lounge, just relax, there's some nice music going, there's dimmed lights, maybe some candles going, and you can just, well, wow, this is a cinema, really? You get to watch great films, and a lot of them. I'm surrounded by creative people, and that's the fun part, I think. That's the part I enjoy the most.
Tumi Itulang there talking with us from Everyman Baker Street Cinema, part of our Meet the Neighbours series.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And I'm joined by one of the Monocle big guys, Andrew Tuck, our editor. Hiya.
That's the first time I've been called big, anyway.
Well, you are. You're a big guy. Like, the heavy brass are coming. And I hear Tyler might be showing up.
Well, he told me to come down here. Now he's not here.
I know. And he's romping around with a furry head thing on, and getting ready for the outdoor cold winter weather that's here.
He likes a little bit of a muff at this time of year because...
Because...
Well, Christmas fair's coming.
It's coming tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Running till 5. Tomorrow and Sunday, it's going to be fabulous.
Yes, and let's be clear, it's open to everybody. We want everybody to come down. It's a Christmas fair where we're going to be doing great food with Grainger & Co. There's a chance to do Christmas shopping. We're going to have a petting zoo again.
With reindeer.
With reindeer. And there's also a chance to give some money to a good cause.
Committee for the Protection of Journalists.
Yes.
Very good cause. We make lots of money, I think, in June at our summer fair.
Yes, and all you have to do is when you come in, you have to guess how many chocolates are in the jar.
How many are in the jar?
There are, oh, no, you see,
okay, nearly
spoiled it.
I tried. You can all, there's also a tombola. Is it tombola or tombola?
It's a tombola.
Well, our tombola is full of gifts that are going to be raffled off.
But some people say tombola like it's an actual person.
Like, knock,
have you seen,
knock,
have
who's
you seen
there?
Tombola.
Speaking of knock, knock, who's there?
It's Mr. Brûlé. He's been
our
found.
Editor-in-chief has just,
I think he was helping put up
in
the kind of the stools. He was like fluffing the fake snow.
Fake snow. It's cold. We might have some real flakes here.
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully not working for us. But anyway.
No. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
And Andrew has just said, let's be clear. We want people to come here. And I've been clear throughout the show.
Good. Absolutely.
Get down here.
No, it's going to be good. And I was just outside just dealing with the reindeer pellets.
What are reindeer pellets? You mean the things they leave behind?
No, the things you feed them. But I think they leave pellets behind.
Behind
as well.
Different kind of pellet.
Yeah, exactly.
Are the reindeer here?
The reindeer are not here yet. I think that they are on a transport aircraft coming from Finland right now.
Well, actually, if you were listening earlier, I was talking with Santa Claus, who had his actual reindeer ready to fly him here tonight.
This is very good news.
So that's
how do the forecasts look, Nancy Durham?
Well, I would like to remind you that less than a week ago, I did announce cold and crisp and sunny. Now, I haven't double-checked this afternoon, but we're seeing pictures of sun, no pictures of raindrops, maybe a bit of cloud now and then.
Can you channel this in the voice of a CBC weather person from your old...
Oh, cool. I'd have to blaspheme, I think. I've been doing blasphemy laws here, too. No, I can't.
Okay.
This is awful.
Now,
I thought you wanted to do weather improv. I can't do weatherman.
Cloudy. I can do things like the BBC weather forecast, German bite of... foggy. You know all those funny, those wonderful names they read early in the morning?
But the reindeer,
the shipping forecast.
The reindeer, they do have pale blue stripes on them. They're Finnair ones. They're coming on a Finnair route from Finland.
Yeah.
My reindeer are coming.
Rain bears.
My rain bears.
I love rain
my
bears.
My reindeer are coming, pulling a sleigh, and I've been announcing this to people, and I've been giving them instructions to watch for Santa Claus crisscrossing the sky this evening, north to south, to land here at the Monocle landing pad.
Wait till you read my column tonight in the Financial Times.
Oh, well, give me a little preview. We've got time.
We do have time. I just talk about what's happening in the state of retail, the ongoing debate about malls versus shopping in the city, online versus bricks and mortar, etc. And I'm just lobbying for Christmas markets.
Well, grotto or no grotto?
Yeah.
That's the debate.
I love it. And I love more markets. And why aren't there more markets? I can't think of another one like this.
Well, I mean, there's a rather large one in Hyde Park. Of course, there are ones all over Middle Europa as well. But we're very excited about the fact that we've got a wonderful collection. Of course, brands coming in as well. You representing a good part of Wales. I'm not sure, Andrew, because as I was just checking out the reindeer palettes, as I said. Have you talked about all the other people that are participating?
No, Alexia Hench is coming.
With Henchman, exactly. Yes. Maison Kitsune from Paris. Miller Harris Fragrances are going to be here.
Daunt Books.
Switzerland. The entire country. I think all 7 million plus people are coming.
Honest John's Records.
Yeah, fantastic.
Love that. Love their music.
And we're going to be stirring up some Glühwein, we think, as well.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. And I'm going to be having some free lavender shortbreads.
Okay.
Giving away from our stand. That's one of the many freebies at the Whale Stand.
Be careful, the reindeer may be making their way over to you.
We've made them so they don't look like pellets.
No, and we've also got DJ Satoshi here, who was here during the summer fair.
Oh, I love him.
He's back. Also, he's here.
I don't believe you brought him back.
Yes, he's here with his girlfriend. She's also going to be doing some special baking tomorrow. And we've got the Finnish Children's Choir. We've got Cecilia Stalin here with also a very small but jazzy up-tempo Swedish choir as well.
This is fantastic. I'm all pumped up. Thanks, guys, for coming in. I am afraid I have to say that's all the time we have for today. We need our rest so we can be here tomorrow. Thanks to our producer, Ala John, researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Our interns today were Imogen Greenhalge, Haley Joelle Ott, and Philly Lim. Next is The Menu. And this week, they're heading to Toronto to investigate the city's booming food scene. Yes, they went to a local microbrewery there, Tyler. Maybe you've visited it yourself.
I don't know. No, no.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 here in London, Gillian DeBias and Romas Viesulis will be back for the Monocle Daily.
It's a nice Latvian name.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.